start to examine what narratives are out there around sustainable transition and about the climate crisis, and why some of these narratives are not actually like, you know, helpful, or they're not like helpful feedback on the system on how to change things, and how they're not counter-hegemonic, but they actually reinforce the system. So one of the major narratives is that people have to do everything sustainably by themselves. Like, they have to champion sustainability by themselves. And if they don't, then they're not like entitled to speak about transition, to speak about climate change, because they're evil people and they should be doing better. And that's what we think is that it's good if you can do something in first person to help the environment, if you can change your habits and your patterns of consumption to make yourself, like, your life carbon footprint more sustainable. But this is like a response which is centered on the role of the individual as a consumer. And it stays and it sits inside the boundaries of what the system allows you to do. And it doesn't really take into account that the system puts a sustainability premium on sustainable options. So, and then if you're not wealthy, if you don't have the economic possibility to like buy green everything, or if you don't have the access to public transport, if you don't have the conditions to ride a bike to work, then you're cut off from being like a sustainability champion in first person.
There is some kind of illusion of choice.
Yeah, exactly. It's the neoliberal illusion of choice at play, saying, look, you mighty consumer, you can do whatever you want, you vote with your wallet, and you can make everything better. And it's actually only part of the picture, because the system is built in a way that doesn't really allow you a choice, like a sort of free choice. It allows you a choice between what's available. So another narrative that is very widespread is, for example, like Jonathan Franzen was coming out. He's a famous novelist. It was coming out with a narrative like this. So it's too late. We've already messed up too much. There's nothing else we can do. We just need to adapt. And by any means, that was inevitable, because humans are flawed. They're morally corrupted. And really, we should have never come out of the epipaleolithic, because agriculture ruined humanity. We should have stayed hunter-gatherers. And maybe, who knows, but at this stage of things, it's not really possible to turn the clock so far back. If you don't know, the epipaleolithic is like 8,000 years ago, sort of, like before the Neolithic Revolution. And the conditions of human life have changed so massively, and the numbers of humans have changed so massively, that it's just not possible to wind back the clock and go back to that. And also, the redistribution of the climate guilt on top of consumers, on top of the general population, doesn't take into account who the major carbon emitters were, who has profited from the destruction of the environment, the exploitation of fossil fuels, from colonialism, from deforestation to build massive plantations of the whatever. It's not humanity as a whole. It's like a very narrow cream at the top of the human mass that has profited massively from this destruction of the environment. And now the people who are poorer, who are like from the global south, who are exploited, are paying the consequences. So it's also like it spreads the guilt around, so no one's actually guilty, and you can safely look at your like belly button and think, oh my god, I need to meditate more, I need to improve my morality, and that's it. So it's not actually that useful. There is another narrative, like Elon Musk will save us, don't worry, technology will just do the trick, which is quite prevalent. So like Bezos said it was going to invest £10 billion in clean technology, everybody was like, whoa, that's sorted, it's solved, like the big players are coming out to play. And this is like, and now the center is private property and private enterprise as the only true leading force in the world. And the only true economic force that can generate the amounts of money necessary for the very expensive, everybody likes to talk about how it's expensive, transition. That's actually not true. So for example, the people from Tax Justice, they just came out with like a special issue on climate and tax justice and saying how much actually states and like public bodies, governments can, how much more money they can generate with the current economic climate and basically borrowing for less than zero interest, they can basically make up the money. So it's counterfactual that only private enterprise can solve the crisis. It's actually like completely ignoring what private enterprise has been doing so far. And it's ignoring the fact that you don't just need technology and you in any way you would need the technology that is fast deploying and like ready tomorrow, or like a very high risk, high reward investment that normally private enterprises don't do because they outsource this to universities. But you also need political and social measures. You need a change in how things are done. You don't just need to change the engine of the growth machine. You just need to rethink the entire machine. So this is also a false solution that distracts from what actually you need, from the true like matter at the earth of the crisis. And lastly, we identified ecofascism as a rising trend in how people tackle the climate crisis and the responses to the climate crisis. So ecofascism is a narrative that actually takes the crisis seriously. It says there's a real crisis, we need to find a solution. The solution is possible. So far, you know, it's not wrong. But then the solutions that are put forward are completely dehumanizing to an entire part of the population. They advocate like authoritarian solutions. They advocate the building of walls and borders as a solution to the climate crisis. They advocate like the keeping the resources of the wealthy north to the wealthy north and not letting these hordes of immigrants coming to our fair shores to actually profit from everything that we have built. This is disgusting. And if we find an eco-fascist, we would rather like to punch them. But
it's not the right solution.
It's not the right, I mean, CO2 knows no borders. Eventually, if we leave the crisis going, mass migration will be even more a strong component of what's going to happen. It's already happening because the caravan, migrant caravan going into the US and the people going across the Mediterranean in whatever they can find that kind of floats are already being caused by climate stress in areas which are already droughty, in areas where the land grabbing and the degradation of the soils are making agriculture less and less viable. So we're already seeing mass migration because of climate. But the solution that ecofascism proposes to this problem is we just chuck them out to sea. That's okay. They're not actual people. They're not real people. So this is wrong in every possible conceivable way. And alongside this, there is the idea that a majority of the problems of climate change are also due to the fact that certain populations reproduce too much, which is a very damaging narrative because the people who are blamed for reproducing too much are actually the people who emit less CO2. They're like emitting a hundredth of the CO2 that a person in the global north who has no children but goes everywhere by car, et cetera, actually produces in a year. So this is basically like blaming the poor for the damage caused by the system that basically favors the global north over them massively. So this is also a false solution that distracts from what is actually the cause of the crisis.
Yeah, so instead we do solarpunk, and we think that it's a better way of building narratives that can actually help envision a just transition, a future that has gone through a just transition or where it's going through it. What is solarpunk? It's a branch of sci-fi that tackles the themes of climate transition and ecological transition, climate change and ecological transition. And it does that with an optimistic point of view, solution-oriented point of view to propose narratives of futures in which cities have reimagined themselves into organisms that can pass through the just transition successfully. In this way, solarpunk can be both a reflection on the system that we're in, because it allows us to think about the solutions that can be implemented, making trades off and assessments of which one of the solutions. And it's also a showcase of these solutions. And by doing this, can also help people to understand what is actually possible. And this is one of the aims that we're also trying to, one of the objectives that we're trying to achieve with the project that we're doing in Milan. To basically bring the solutions, the technology, the knowledge, and everything that is built around it to the population that actually doesn't know it, but that represents the local reality in which these solutions will be implemented. So connecting these two poles, is one of the aims of our solarpunk. But it's not just technology. So as we were saying, what is needed also is also a social change and a political, in a sense that we need to implement policies that help this kind of social change. Because most of, like, a lot of the problems, as Laura was saying just like some minutes ago, most of the problems depends on social conditions, problems related to climate change, as you probably already know. Also, solarpunk helps us reevaluating traditional and indigenous knowledge that might have been replaced by something that is more affordable at a
higher environmental cost. Yeah,
exactly. And in this sense, with all these traits, solarpunk can also be a design tool or a set of tools that can be given to whoever is participating, to local communities, for example, to help them design their version of the sustainable future.
So a lot of studies have been done on how narration is one of the frameworks by which people understand the world and by which communication is delivered. So, like, narrations are part of advertisement, are part of journalism. Narrations are everywhere. And narrations condition what we understand of the world and what we can imagine about the world in the future. It's sort of like a truism in the climate justice, eco-socialist environment that it's easier to imagine the end of the world than it is to imagine the end of capitalism. Because the narrative about capitalism is so strong and it's hegemonic and it's everywhere. And wherever you look, there is like a little tiny facet about capitalism in your narratives. So to help people transcend this hegemonic narrative, they need to be involved in sort of like a process to design what an alternative narrative could be. And this process of involving people in designing their futures falls under the umbrella of participatory design, which is a form of design that includes all the stakeholders, the local population, et cetera, et cetera. There's lots of techniques that can be used within participatory design. One of the main ones is called backcasting. So backcasting is sort of the opposite of forecasting. In which forecasting, you start from where you are now, and you try to figure out, like, in 10 years, 20 years, where you're going to be. Backcasting basically short-circuits the whole thing and says, okay, let's imagine the end state that we want. So in this case, it's like, let's imagine how Milan or a neighborhood of Milan would look like once we got the just transition to a sustainable future down path. Let's imagine we've done it. And let's describe what it looks like. And then from there, you extrapolate what steps you need to take to get from where you are now to where you want to be in 50 years' time, sort of, 30 years' time, wherever. So this is backcasting. Another tool that can be used and is very powerful is helping people discuss. So like guiding the discussion by providing those tools of like knowledge and competence that people are lacking to interpret their own situation. So people, most of the time when you ask them about their environment, their society, their work, they identify problems, they have problems, but maybe they can't conceptualize those problems. So a part of the process of helping them design their future is giving them the tools to conceptualize the problems that they have. And once they can conceptualize, they can also discuss like what the possible solutions are, what the trade-offs are, what is best for the local reality. And a third technique that we like to use a lot is role-playing. So we ask people to imagine, well, if you were like the local authority and you were given this sort of set of data and decisions, what decisions would you make? What are the trade-offs? You identify like the consequences. So people can like get into the gear of figuring out how they can design, how they can plan, how the processes of decisions should be done in a democratic way. And all of this that can be consolidated by like large group discussions and citizens' assemblies, etc. So Solarpunk has already been used as a speculative design tool. So, but in a very like, it's sort of like in a limited way, either limited because the design process was only extended to a set of experts, either because they're narrators or because they are expert in sustainability, or it has been limited in time and limited in reach because it was a limited time event, or both. So one of the examples is the anthology, The Weight of Light, that was done by University of Arizona. I think by Clark Miller, who's in this chat, another Clark
exactly.
Miller.
Exactly.
It could be him. So The Weight of Light was an anthology where a group of narrators from the solarpunk speculative fiction communities were asked to write about a series of future choices for like rural environments, semi-rural environments, large-scale cities, and some of the subsets in between. And this anthology is really nice. It has essays. It has very nice stories. But it's the design process was just done within a small group of experts, activists, and narrators. There's another experience is the Solarpunk Fest Berlin by Ellery Studio. Solarpunk Future Fest Berlin by Ellery Studio. It was like a limited time event that happened, I think, in 2018 in Berlin. Where the public was exposed to a series of exhibits, interactive role play experiences, etc. So they could discuss, they could imagine the future, they could tinker around with the future. But that was like an event that was held in one city at one time, and I think they're planning to repeat it, but we haven't heard about a repeat experience yet. And the coronavirus situation is making everything so much difficult. A third experience was the Future & Co. interactive theater that was done in Budapest during a festival of arts. So it worked through the backcasting process, which is a very powerful process, but the backcasting was done within a group of experts, so business leaders, activists, so people who have like a high amount of previous knowledge. And then the scenarios that came from the backcasting were given to were like made accessible to the public through an interactive theater experience that ran for a few days in Budapest. This is also like limited because the scenarios were drawn up by a limited subset of people, and because the experience was, I think it was like limited to maybe a week in Budapest. So not everybody who would have benefited from this experience was actually able to go and do it. And the thing is, given the crisis we're in, given that people are so much oppressed by a crisis after the other, the crisis of the economy, the crisis of democracy, the crisis of the environment, and they're actually all aspects of the same crisis, they probably, a lot of people can't see a way out. It's just like the way things are. You know, capitalism and this system is the inevitable conclusion of human endeavors, which is another narrative that you sometimes hear about. Like, this was inevitably written in the stars ever since we first took a tool and started like digging a field for agriculture. So people suffer from an excess of problems and a lack of imagination to find solutions, to congregate behind the solutions that exist, the solutions that are positive and propositive. So this method of solarpunk-ish, I don't know if Future & Co. would actually define themselves as solarpunk, but we sort of do because that's what they look like. This process of participatory design through narrative, through solarpunk attitudes, needs to be extended. It needs to be like brought in the field, sort of, and used as a way to engage people with the just transition, with the climate justice in general.
Yeah, in fact, this is very much what we're trying to do with the projects that we are currently doing in Milan, which is called Postcards from a Possible Future. So basically what we're trying to do here is connect the experts that can help envision these future scenarios with the local communities, so they can work together instead of like having the experts conceive a solution that can later be applied to communities in another place. We think that by making them work together, they can actually conceive solutions that are more interesting, and that can be more to which the local community can relate more. The pillars of our project are learn, discuss, and create. These are like the three main phases. Learn is all about, as I said, like connecting experts in the local community, the community of two neighbors in Milan, by lessons and workshops. Basically, we aim to pass the knowledge on a series of topics related to climate change and sustainability, like, for example, what is solar energy and how can it be applied?
Urban agriculture,
yes, building a urban garden. And now, obviously, they don't come to my mind. Well, there is a lot, like, a range of topics. After we've done this part of like passing the knowledge, we aim to produce discussions on how this knowledge can be transformed into a working solution for that community.
By that community,
exactly. Not just now, not just what can be done now, but what can be done, where we want to go, where we want to be in 10, 20, 30 years.
And how we can build like a workable plan to get there. What, like, exactly, other steps, what do they need to know to make the further steps in planning as well?
Exactly. And the final part of the project would be to create scenarios, which means images and text, of the horizon that we want to reach for. And all this content is going to be published on a website that can be accessible to the whole city. So even though we worked with just two local communities, with two neighborhoods that we're trying to empower with this project, the rest of the city can have access to all the work that we've done as well. And basically that's one of the examples. That's what we try to, how we try to percolate solar punk into today's society.
Mm-hmm. Make it like a practical thing that people can do. So solar punk is not just an adjective, but it's a verb that of what people do to their cities, do to their communities, how they push forward the sustainability agenda by helping their neighbors, their friends, their parents imagine what the future can be like.
Yeah, exactly. And that is it, basically.
Yeah, that's it. Fire the questions.
Okay, so I have a kind of not very well-formed question now and not very well-formed stream of thoughts based on what you said. But one of the things that strikes me that's super important about this project and something that's been missing from what we've been doing in the Green New Deal is this attempt to revive utopia, utopian thinking as, you know, an object of desire, a demand for some future states to be realized, and a kind of a form of political demand that's almost disappeared with, you know, capitalist realism and neoliberalism and all that. We don't think in utopian terms. We think of what's, you know, what in technocratic terms, in terms of what's possible at the, you know, margins of any social or political problem. And so it's really important to engage in these acts of almost prefiguring the future and imagining as a way of instilling people with hope and with political imagination and so on. But when you think about the scale of the transformation that's necessary today in the very short term, how do you also scale that power of utopian imagination beyond these kinds of local things that you engage with? I mean, it might be a simple answer. It might be just, you know, training up a ton of organizers around the world to do the kinds of things you're doing, but maybe there are other ideas. And then have you thought at all about the way in which the coronavirus and the kinds of measures of exception that are being talked about and implemented, which would have seemed insane 2 months ago, but are now being treated as a new normal, if there's any way in which this moment could act as a catalyst for a broader change in thinking around the world towards these more utopian visions of what the future should hold?
Yes, the Green New Deal for Europe like inspired us a lot, and I was marginally involved as like the annoying activist that was commenting on everything without actually having like a degree in sustainability science, because I am a structural biologist. Actually, next week I'm going to be working on coronavirus, because that's what you do. The imagining what is possible is very important. And this role of imagination is not something that we came up with. Like, there is the Transition Towns Network in the UK. Their leader, his name escapes me now, just came up with last year with a book. It's called From What If to What Is. And it's basically doing this, but he's doing it with his own local groups, and he's come up with a book mostly by himself and with his small number of people. The problem is that we've seen in the activist community here where we live in the UK, the activist community is always the same people. We can't get many more people to engage. So how do we get these extra people who have problems? They have all the problems. How do we get them to engage in a way that is constructive with these problems and doesn't result in them voting for the first strong person, usually is a man, but let's say person, that promises they're going to find a solution single-handedly? How do we get these people to get involved? That's why we decided to go in the communities to do the work with the local communities.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, yeah, basically what is important for us is to also try to go into the communities that are not usually involved in this kind of reasoning and try to pass the knowledge and pass the message over there. It's challenging, I can say, but we're trying to work from the ground up as well, and not just like on the same kind of circles of people. But I think that
slowly when we get to there.
Yeah, exactly. But also trying to multiply the number of narratives, multiply the number of stories can help in this case, because it can help somebody that is not involved imagine a solution that is actually going to be possible.
On the other hand, like, we need many more groups to start doing this. I mean, Transition Towns in the UK has been wonderful. They've been doing this for a lot of time. But to be fair, there is a Transition Town group in a lot of places, and not all of them are actually successful in engaging with the vulnerable communities, like the migrants, like the people who are really, really socially disadvantaged because they don't have much money, with the disabled people, with like all the small groups, well, small and not small groups, that have a particular stake in the climate crisis because they're going to be the worst affected. And otherwise, if we don't engage, we might end up with a solution that works for people who have money, or works for people who have social privilege, works for those who are least oppressed. So in the UK, the UK Green New Deal effort, which I think is also allied with the Green New Deal for Europe through the Commonwealth Project, they're going to train a lot of Green New Deal activists, lots of Green New Deal organizers. So this is a very positive thing that's going to, hopefully, when these special measures are done, it's going to supercharge the discourse in the local communities. If we don't start from the local communities, then we're going to be a bit at a loss on how the top-down approaches, especially towards the people who are more vulnerable, a lot of the time they sound like austerity. They sound like, we don't want you to do this, we don't want you to do that. But the part about how this is going to make their lives better and how this is going to make them empowered, all that part is often missing. So that's very important.
Yeah. And on the coronavirus,
you go.
I think it can be a catalyst, or a starting point at least. I was reading recently, we were reading it, that there is a link between pollution and the spreading of coronavirus, in the sense that, for example, in Milan, in the region around Milan, where it has like a massive impact and where we came from, it's an area that is quite highly, it's extremely polluted, exactly. The particulate?
Yeah, the PM10 and PM5 and PM stuff.
Are quite at a very high level. And somebody made a link between these two things. So there is like, now that we know this, now that we know that pollution and the spreading of these kind of very dangerous diseases are connected. And coronavirus is important because it has visible immediate impact. It's not just like,
it's not a slow burn,
it's a spike,
immediate emergency. It's not like in 10 years we're not gonna have this. It's like right now pollution is supercharging a pandemic in some areas of the world. But it's not just that, like, the pandemic itself has been generated by destruction of environment. So like the major pandemics recently are zoonosis, which means it's a disease that starts in animals and then through either directly or through an intermediate animal host, which is normally like a animal husbandry species, so poultry or pigs, it jumps into humans. And this is because in the last 60 years, a lot of like rainforest environments and like primary forest environments have been degraded. Oh, Clark Miller is actually the Clark Miller. Yeah, all of these degraded environments where people have been going and disturbing species, they are like a place where these viruses can easily jump between species. And in truth, like the system, the austerity and the degradation of social and medical services has also played a huge impact on how countries are responding. The austerity in the UK and in Italy has made so that like the crisis is actually much more serious than it should have been, because so many beds have been cut, so many doctors have been cut, and now we are in a regime of special measures. So these special measures, they are a reflection of that states and public bodies and governments can act fast, but they are also like, let's say, authoritarian.
Yeah, they limit our personal liberties. So,
which in an emergency is cool, but yeah, exactly. If they get extended, so the UK is planning to make a law that the special measures are going to last 2 years.
Yeah.
So this is going to probably be, hopefully be longer than the actual crisis. But this can be like a springboard for like larger limitations of like personal life or like surveillance, because there are rumors or like partially substantiated news of people using apps for phone tracking so they can make sure that people don't go anywhere. But how do we make sure that these measures that coerce individual liberty, then they don't get like, they don't continue past the emergency? So this is both like a good thing and a bad thing, to be fair.
Yeah, so I think that the key is try to keep the attention high on the link between the two things after the crisis has passed. Try to keep the attention high. I hope you understand. It answers your questions.
So next up is Clark Miller.
Thanks. I just had to find the unmute button. This is fantastic. I really appreciate you all doing this webinar today, and I've learned an enormous amount. So thank you. And been a really interesting discussion.
Being.
Yeah, you bet. You know, I the question that I had was, I think, very similar to Pavel's, and that is this question of how do we sort of scale and accelerate these kinds of works. You know, I used to be at the University of Wisconsin, and I always remember what somebody told me. There are 18,000 municipalities in the state of Wisconsin, which is about an average sort of size state in the United States, right? So when we talk about doing this at a kind of local community level, we're literally talking about tens, hundreds of millions of communities across the globe. And, you know, I think one of the things we've realized with coronavirus the last few days, at least what I've been thinking about, is just how tightly tied our infrastructure is into our imagination that tomorrow is going to be just like today.
Right?
That what we're going to do tomorrow is we're going to get up, we're going to get in our car, our public transit or our bicycle, we're going to go to work, we're going to spend the day at work, we're going to come home, right? And so that expectation on everybody's part, that imagination of what that future is going to look like, is what holds our infrastructure together. And when all of a sudden an entire planet full of people starts to imagine that tomorrow is not going to be like today or like yesterday, but rather different, and that we need to act differently, all of a sudden all kinds of things start to break about how our global systems are supposed to work, right? I mean, the air transportation industry is about to fold. And in less than a week, it's about to fold, essentially, absent major, major state intervention. So imagination can be really fast. And it's unbelievably important in terms of our relationship to our infrastructures. And so the question is, I mean, I think the challenge with thinking about coronavirus as a either an example or a catalyst is that everybody's instructions have been go home, right? In other words, and all the interventions are about restore to the status quo. You know, can we get back to where we were? And so I'm a little, you know, that goes back to that idea that we all have in our heads, in our imagination, where we were before coronavirus hit. And we know what our lives were like, and we just want to get back there. And so I'm a little skeptical that this is going to be some transformative moment. Although obviously the things we're doing now could very well reverberate going forward. So I do think this question of how do we scale these kinds of imaginative exercises that allow people to imagine their relationships to infrastructure differently, and how do we accelerate? Because it's a, as you guys know from doing this, and we've done it now several times now with different communities, it's a slow process to reimagine our relationships to infrastructure. And so how do we, I think we need a multi-scale strategy where we're not just working on the ground with communities, but working with institutions that network communities and that work above communities to help support that work at the community level. You know, I think I've been talking to the folks at the National Renewable Energy Laboratory here about how do we take their assets as a place that has thousands of scientists and engineers, kind of like the Joint Research Center in Northern Italy, thousands of scientists who work on renewable energy. How do we turn them into an asset for communities that can help them do this kind of work, but not in a way that says, hey, here's the answer, but rather in a way that says, hey, here's a bunch of knowledge that yeah. you can use to work on your own future. So anyway, great contributions today. Thank you.
Cheers.
Cheers. Do you want to start?
No, I think it's better that you start. You just look okay. Like you have an idea. I need to elaborate a bit.
No, basically, thank you very much for being here. Your book is amazing. So basically,
thank you.
It's not an easy answer. I think that what we can do to scale up and to accelerate the process, like what we try to reach a broader audience, is to give shape to, how can I say that? It's not easy. Like, produce scenarios that can have an impact on the imagination of whoever is watching or reading, so they can act as, they can help spread these kind of scenarios, and then it can kind of help on making it easier to transfer the knowledge itself, not just the story, but also the knowledge that builds up the story. You know what I mean? In the sense that you were saying, like, here's a bunch of scientists that have the building blocks. How do we connect these building blocks? How do we make people aware of these, of the fact that the building blocks exist? And so that's what we're trying to do, like, trying to conceive narratives in the form of images or stories that can have an impact on, like, that can strike the eye and the mind of whoever is watching and reading, so they can work with more word of mouth and help spread the knowledge.
I think, like, one of the partners, key partners of, like, the climate justice movement is also the trade union movement. So the trade unions are less and less powerful now because of neoliberalism, but they are still, like, a very important player in workplace relationship, and they have numbers on their side. So if we can work with the workplaces, if we can work with the trade unions, And the trade unions themselves have shown that this can be done. So like the during the original New Deal and during the war effort of World War II in the US, the unions were like a major player in how fast things changed. And if we can get the unions on board, and the unions in many places are already quite on board, especially I know in the UK because I work closely with unions as a member of Earth Strike UK. They are moving, but they can't move fast enough unless the membership at the base is convinced. And in many cases, the unions of like the university people, the union of professionals is completely on board, but the union of people who build things, like the mechanics and the engineers and the construction workers, they're really worried that the transition is going to be another bunch of austerity measures, and that's going to cost them their job. So there needs to be like a synergy. There needs to be a synergy between the trade union and especially like the most progressive trade unions and the climate justice movement. And narratives can be a tool to engage workers in imagining what the sustainable workplace of their future is going to be like. Is it going to be more democratic, less democratic? What is going to change in the way they work? What is going to change in the way the work is organized, etc.? And I think as well that this moment of crisis, which is peeling away all like the niceties of capitalism, sort of. So the people who are left without sick pay, the people who are basically left to the wolves because they have their work for Uber, and if they don't work, they don't get paid, they don't get sick leave, etc. There is a lot of stuff which is going on, which is going to make people think, look, this system has just let me down again. How do we steer all of this disillusionment with the system away from ecofascism, away from fascism in general, and towards like the sustainable future of the Green New Deal that we all have in mind? We need to sort of ramp up the effort and connect with the organizations that organize these people, like with the independent trade unions, with the renters associations, et cetera, because there is a lot of untapped energy and a lot of people who are realizing that the normal was the problem, that we can't go back to normal because the normal was actually something fragile that worked only as long as nothing else came first. It was not like they were not actually being protected. They were being protected only as long as it served a purpose.
Another thing that might help. All right. Okay, Fernando. one of the things that can actually, I think they can actually answer part of this question is, as well, is one of the things that we're trying to do with the project in Milan. We're working with the local communities, but we're also trying to, because we were actually asking ourselves these very questions when we designed the project. We are trying to, like, in developing an image for the local neighborhoods, we're also producing a document which is going to be kind of a list of things that can be done for the neighborhood. And that will be a document that we're going to hand over, if we get a chance, to the local authorities.
To the mayor.
And to the mayor, you know, trying to reach various levels of higher ups.
Yeah, higher ups.
In this sense, we're trying to connect the local community with people that can do something, but not as much. Like, they can work on a smaller scale with people that can actually work on a bigger scale because they've got like the resources and the
people power.
Exactly. So I think that can help as well. Like, trying to take what is desired from the local communities and make it available to the people that can actually take the decisions. I think there was Alex with a comment.
Yeah. So for me, this presentation was also super helpful because right now in Porto, we are like working on a project for people's assemblies here. And since this is like a process of deliberation of communities, so far we were mostly having this a bit more of a, okay, we invite people presenting concepts, people are discussing maybe some issue, let's say problems and how they want to move forward. But since this is a very narrow way of deliberation, for me it was very interesting also to broaden a little bit this idea of how to deliberate, maybe putting different kind of concepts together, like you were saying, okay, how do you imagine the future and how do we a backcasting, so what would be your backcasting to this, so how we can combine different ways of people conceptualizing the future. So definitely very helpful for me. Thanks.
Thank you very much.
No worries.
Thanks. It's a pleasure. There was
Peter?
Yes.
Peter Anderson. Peter Anderson. Are you still there?
I'm still here. Can you not see me?
Ah, yeah, now we can. The screen is jumping a bit.
Sorry. Hello. Hi, Peter.
Yeah, hi. I was going back to what you were saying about transition towns, and I think as Alex mentioned, people's assemblies. I mean, I don't know how much people have been following Extinction Rebellion, but when they had these ideas about local democracy, I don't know if anyone's been following that. You know, which is kind of people's assemblies, local people getting together. I mean, I'm kind of getting a bit disillusioned with it because it sounded like a great idea, but they're not really running with it. But I mean, to me, I think you were sort of, Laurie, sort of wondering how we get this moving. And I think that is the answer, that to these local democratic meetings and try to rally around the Green New Deal. And the Green New Deal, it's great, but it's what we want system change. We need a new system to replace what we've got. I think that's, I think I sound like I'm rambling, but yeah, I think the problem is we don't have, like when Thatcher came in, they had the neoliberal system. I mean, they'd been planning it for decades and it was all ready to go. And I think the problem now is we don't have, we've got some good ideas, but they haven't coalesced into a system. So I think for me, like as you said, you need a narrative. So the problem is, I mean, people were sort of saying, why didn't they vote for Corbyn? But the thing is, he didn't, they were just starting to have some interesting ideas, but they didn't have a kind of finished system. I think that's what we need. And then you can sell it as a narrative. I don't know, does this make any sense? I don't know.
Yeah, sure. No. Definitely you need like to imagine a complete narrative. So you can basically, because if you've got like different pieces that are not connected, you risk making people confused, I guess, I think.
Sure.
And, but yeah, local democracy, like the assemblies are, you want to say something?
So the thing is, local democracy and assemblies, it's fundamental, but the way...
It's a difficult instrument. It's a powerful tool, but it depends on how you use it, right?
The thing is, like, some things like Sortition and citizens' assemblies made by Sortition, they sort of make everything sound like it's not ideological at all. And as long as you have, like, a random variation between people, you have, like, a sort of, like, scientific sampling between people of different extractions, you're going to come up with a common-sense solution. But a lot of people don't have the instruments because the education is being gutted by neoliberalism, because the narratives that you see in television, in newspapers, in print, everywhere are like strongly influenced by the hegemonic narrative. Fingers. What does it mean?
Extinction Rebellion is like an interjection for a direct point. I mean, yeah, what I was going to say, I have no faith really in the citizens' assemblies, the sortition things. It's so random. I just can't see how that can work.
We're Italian, so we're a bit burned by the assertion thing because it was proposed by the Movimento Cinque Stelle, which then was very disappointing in practice.
I think we
don't know. I mean, it can, ideally, in a perfect system where everybody is informed, everybody has time to get informed, the education is good at everything, it would work. The thing is, you don't have all of these things. Like, the education is very elitist in the UK.
What I was meaning was that I think the citizen assembly idea just doesn't make any sense to me. I think XR is just completely barking up the wrong tree. But as I said, I think it's actual real democracy and local people like Rojava, communalism, you know, real debate and democracy. I just think this citizens assembly thing is just nonsense. I think
because we weren't chosen for any of the citizens assemblies. What we're trying to do in Milan is more like a people's assembly, which is self-selected. People who want to turn up, they just turn up. You have an assembly as big as the people who turn up, and by promoting engagement, we just want as many people as possible to turn up. And we expect that there's going to be people who are going to be confrontational. That's why we're in the project, we're getting the help of social and linguistic mediator and conflict mediators and psychologists. So people who are oppressed, more oppressed or less privileged, they're going to be able to talk, and they're not going to be talked over by the people who are more like, they have better theoretical and practical instruments, but they might have really bad ideas, you know. You need to try and level the field by helping the people who don't have access to knowledge and practical knowledge to get to a level where they know what they're talking about. Because if you don't empower people to make their own choices, and you just like everybody who has a random idea to talk, you're not going to have quality outputs. You know, you're not going to have workable solutions, because it's going to degenerate in a very
common knowledge.
Yeah, in sort of like
whatever. Maybe you will end up redoing the same errors that were just like done.
The thing is, democracy requires people's engagement, education, and people's ability to engage in democracy. That's why, like in ancient Greece, in classical Athens, people were supposed to go to the plays, because the plays discussed issues of morality, of law, of like general philosophy, and they were an accessible way for people to engage with those topics. If you don't allow people the time and the leisure, and in ancient Greek, they actually paid people to go to go and inform themselves. It was not just a self-selected thing. You were supposed to go, and if you went, you were paid for it, because it was a foundational thing of the city. It was a foundational thing of the polis, that people needed to be on the same page. They needed to be informed. They needed to be able to discuss with the right instruments. The point you're making, that in some assemblies people had to be explained that global warming was real, it's not the fault of Extinction Rebellion itself. It's not the fault of the format of the assembly either. It's the fault of, like, people are really poorly educated, and this is due to neoliberalism and the cuts in education and the impossibility for people to raise in sort of the social scale, which is a sort of like a fact in the UK. Like, the social mobility is really low in the UK. The access to higher education is really low. It's not so much like the format is wrong or Extinction Rebellion is doing the things wrong. I think it's very naive to think that it will work out and people will sort of like become wise all of a sudden if the bases are not covered. You're trying to doing things like this is like trying to run before you can walk. If people are not informed, because the information sucks, and it does, like the newspapers in the UK are very biased, et cetera, et cetera. The communication, the information is, they can get is very biased. Then if you don't have the right input, of knowledgeable people who are prepared, who are engaged, then you're not going to get the right output. And I think that's like pretty commonsensical.
Paolo, you wanted to add something maybe?
So Travis had, wanted to speak before me, and then if anyone still has the patience for me, I will just respond to Peter very quickly.
Thank you, Pavel. Thank you. I would like to carry on where Peter was talking about, that we have to have a place where we're going. This was one of the Yanis Varoufakis thing was, you know, post-capitalism. We have to have that idea what we're going to offer people, what we think it should look like. All these projects we're doing is leading up to that. But if we don't know where we're going in the end of it, it's not going to be an easy journey. And even the journey we're going to plan will not suit everybody, because that's one of those impossible things we have in life. That was the only thing I really wanted to say, was just to carry on what Peter was saying, that we've got to look further. We need to, the DM itself needs to have its plan in place where we're going. The Green New Deal is all part of it. The END is part of it. Everything's part of it. But where are we going? Okay, that's my 10 cents worth. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks a lot. There was,
Pavel.
Travis, was no, that that's, that's your comment? Came. Yeah, all right, okay.
Pavel's up now.
Okay, so just a slight comment. I completely agree with the critique of citizens' assemblies as they are being pitched by Exara. And I think if we unpack that critique a little bit, it's actually really instructive as a demand for the broader climate movement. So in my eyes, the way that Exara uses citizens' assemblies is in two ways. In one way, it's to kind of prefigure in the streets this world of perfect democracy in which every voice counts, which doesn't count for anything because there's absolutely no mandate on politicians to, you know, there's no way in which the decisions reached by these activist assemblies are going to be followed by politicians. And also because as Laura said, a lot of the time people engaging in them lack the expertise to really articulate the kind of vision that we might want to pursue. People lose interest over time and they don't make very reasoned conclusions. And we saw this in Occupy Wall Street, where the citizens' assemblies carried on for 3 years and then fizzled out when people got bored. But the second, and I think bigger issue with Exara's formulation of citizens' assemblies is that in their view, or in their framing, it's a political demand on states to create these new structures with constitutional weight that will have the authority to determine our course out of the climate crisis. And that's a really radical political demand that's almost more radical than asking governments to do what's necessary and implement a just transition. And the problem with it is that, in their view, citizens' assemblies are the structures that will guide us. They'll be the catalysts for the just transition that's needed. But instead, in my eyys, the just transition is almost a necessary precondition for the kind of direct democracy that they're calling for. Because as long as you don't have economic justice and some kind of equity, people aren't going to have the time to engage in citizens' assemblies. You're not going to have the right levels of education, as Laura was talking about, for people to be able to make these decisions. And so it's wrong-headed precisely because it foregrounds the democratic exercise, whereas the demand has to be first to create the conditions for public participation. So that was just a comment, not so much a question.
Thank you. Just understanding quickly, because my benefit to everyone, to Fernando, the whole work that we're doing with the project in Milan is going to be published on a dedicated website on which we're currently working. If you're interested on the updates that we're like doing every time that we meet with the local communities, you can follow Facebook page and the website of the social cooperative that's actually helping us connect with those local communities, which is Amelink Onlus. And you can find them on Facebook and on the website, which I believe Amelink is amelink.eu.
Of course, it just decided it was something different.
that might work.
Yeah. That'll be the right thing.
Yeah, sorry, I didn't mean to like disrupt the conversation. It's just that just wanted to understand to answer to Fernand. You had something to
add? No, I think it's right. I mean, we have to have a working model of how things are gonna pan out during the transition. We have to have practical examples on how things are gonna be different, but we need to work with like stakeholders such as community, local communities, trade unions, etc., to have these working models of how things are going to work out that then can be expanded. I also think that trying direct democracy in a condition in which people sometimes have to work three jobs and they're self-excluding because they don't have the time and people don't have access to quality education, quality information, etc., it's sort of like putting the cart before the oxen. But that doesn't mean that a person who is not like an activist can't come up with good ideas. It's just going to be much harder to get everybody to the same level. You're going to have to do a foreground, you're going to have to do a sort of back office work to get these people to conceptualize and get everybody on the same page on like language, on conventions, on how you define things. It's sort of like a Socratic exercise before you can get people to talk and mean the same things when they say the same word. This is not just in citizens' assemblies, but like in the workplace. I work in a multidisciplinary science team, and sometimes we've been working together for more than 10 years, and sometimes you still have like people are talking completely across purposes because they mean different things with the same sort of word or phrase. Can you imagine like having hundreds of people with completely different backgrounds and completely different levels of engagement and information on a topic, and suddenly they have to decide and the decision is binding? It seems like not an optimal way of doing things. We need to go further and further into democracy. But you're basically saying, let's skip local democracy. We're just going to have national democracy on a sample of scientifically chosen, randomly chosen people. Whereas maybe like starting from people actually implementing democracy in their local communities and then communities coalescing to democratically decide things about their town and then their region, etc., might be a better way of going about things. And yeah, that's sort of.
Yeah, it. No, that's in terms of the questions you mean. Like,
yeah,
I think we covered everyone. Like, if there is anybody else that has anything to ask,
I had another question.
Yeah, Alexander, sorry.
Because also in this conversation, it really made sense for me that also beyond just going to citizens or people and talk to them and developing concepts and ideas, basically with this idea of assemblies, that we also, of course, have to talk to groups, something like organized units already, like trade unions. And so my question was, if you have done it already, how do you approach them in terms of this participative narrative, like developing ideas together, have you done this? How do you approach this?
In the UK, we're very lucky that there is a campaign. It's called the New Lucas Plan, and it's based on a experience that was in the 70s, I think. So Lucas Aerospace was a company that made parts for fighter jets and like military equipment. And all of at some point, the trade unions presented to the management a plan to like convert the factory, convert the production to civilian production instead. Because they were like anti-imperialist, they were anti-war, and they said, look, this is wrong. We can't be producing like parts of fighter jets forever and ever. It's something that we need to stop doing. And here is a plan. We designed it together. Here's a plan of how we're going to do it through the trade unions. And we can do this in X time. And this was known as the Lucas plan. So the new Lucas plan is a group of trade unionists that want to implement the spirit of the Lucas plan for the just transition. They want like people in the workplaces to figure out how they can change things from the workplace up. So they are really good. They're really friendly. If things actually continue as they are scheduled now, we will be doing a panel session with them at the Manchester Degrowth conference in September. And they have a lot of good ideas. I think in Portugal, there is like the Climaximo experience. Like I met with them in Lisbon this December. I was there for seeing family and they're really friendly. I don't know if you already know them because they said they had a chapter in Porto, but they're also working with trade unions, with several small trade unions for the Empregos Pro Clima report. And there is like an analogous report in the UK, which is called the 1 million jobs for climate. And I expect that like trade unions across Europe are going to be a really good point of contact to get like workers to reflect on how they can do things in a sustainable way. What are the steps that you need to get to a sustainable and democratically directed workplace? But yeah, we're still trying to contact, like to get in touch with the trade unions. Earth Strike UK was trying to get into all the conferences, but they're all being canceled because of coronavirus. Yeah, exactly. We were trying to like step up the engagement with the trade unions, but everything is a bit up in the air. We're doing most of the work online now, but yeah, it's...
Just to answer Natalie, I don't know if I understood your question correctly, but I am the artist in this. So I am doing the art part. And I participate in all the meetings that I can go to with the local communities. It also happens that I am one of the coordinators of the project, but my main job is to actually take whatever comes out of those meetings and turn this list of requirements into an image or a scenario of what that neighborhood would be in after the just transition or during the just transition. So the part of the artist is to stay, I think, for the way that we conceive the project, to stay with the community, the local community, from the beginning of the transition project, to help them envision what they would like to achieve. I hope this answers your question.
It was rather you're one or you're hundreds or thousands.
Oh no! At the moment, I'm one.
That was my point. That was my point. It's just we need much, much more. We need all of them.
True. Definitely. We're trying to, you know, get in touch with other people. Now the project is a bit small. It's but hopefully, if things go well, we'll be able to scale it up and then build a team that develops this kind of visions.
Yeah, I mean, if you're an artist, come and do stuff with us. We always need more artists. To be fair, there's lots of like people who do crafts in Solarpunk.
Yes, exactly.
There is a good friend of ours who is not with us today because she couldn't make it, but she does lots of like fiber crafts about Solarpunk with like an environmental focus. And there are lots of illustrators that do sort of like speculative future illustration. The thing is, we need like the artists to talk to the trade unionists, talk to the activists, and not just focus on doing really pretty illustrations of the, you know, cookie cutter city in the middle of the cookie cutter floodplain with the cookie cutter high rises made of steel and solar panels, because each local reality is gonna adapt and mitigate climate change in a different way, because the central issues are gonna be different. In one place, it could be water scarcity, and the other one could be like floods, etc. So we need artists to engage with the efforts for the just transition, and not just produce beautiful art, but produce
an objective.
Yeah, produce art with a local focus, sort of.
Yeah, go for it, Alex.
Since you also were talking about Climaximo, I met with one like a month ago in Lisbon, and he told me he's also one of the founders of a small collective or movement here in Portugal called 2 Degrees, I think. And so their idea is to use art also to oppose, not oppose, but to work in with this context of against resource extraction and destroying the nature. And especially, so the struggle that he articulated for me was that in Portugal, a lot of artists are actually funded through fossil fuels company because they are one of the largest. So a lot of festivals, for example, they are funded by the big gas or electricity companies. And so I was wondering if you have like, how is your experience with that kind of struggles? Like if you're an artist, money, making a living, for example.
Yeah, no, definitely. Yeah, I struggle with that on a daily basis. Would you want to say something about that? Or
so we've been talking to a bunch of people from like BP or not BP, or like other campaigns that resist the sponsorship of fossil fuels into art. This is, I think, an issue which is not just in Portugal, even though people were laughing their asses off when the roof of the Maat came down in Lisbon for the storm Elsa. And I was at the meeting in Climaximo when they were like, oh my God, this must be like a punishment to EDF because they're the major sponsor of the museum. And they were like, this is the only good thing that ever happened in Maat. But yeah, they were being sarcastic, but it's an issue not just in Portugal, but in the UK as well. So the Royal Shakespeare Company, the Tate Gallery, the British Museum, and the Globe Theatre, I think, they all had sponsorship of BP or Shell. Now there are like, I think 3 out of 4 of them dropped the sponsorship because of the relentless, tireless work of activists. So BP or not BP and a series of other campaigns. They have been literally getting themselves arrested by doing like flash mobs and all sorts of stunts and relentlessly campaigning against a art sponsorship by fossil fuels. What they want to do is like revoke their social license to operate. They're not like, they can't clean up their act by saying, look, we make a lot of money by destroying the environment, but at least we give some money to art. So I think this is very important, and I think they're super duper brave because they get like booted out of the museums a lot, they get arrested, they get all their stuff confiscated, and they are really like humorous and badass, because last time they just made like a massive Trojan horse, because the exhibition on Troy at the British Museum was sponsored by BP. And they were like taking, sort of like being sarcastic about how much of a cursed gift the sponsorship of BP for the British Museum actually is. And they went in there like all dressed up as Greek and Trojans, covered in oil, with a massive, huge ass, Trojan horse made of wood. So they're like really amazing.
Anything to say about that?
So Clark said about the about the ownership of solar energy in private context and not just energy sector. So and how to make it community oriented. As far as I know, so far the idea of having your own solar is being restricted to people who are house owners, which is a thin layer of the population. According to the latest data, property is very concentrated, and it's a lot of people don't own their own homes. They don't have capital to invest in solar, which is like still like a buying solar panels enough to power your own home is a significant investment, and not everybody has a home and has the money to buy the solar panels. So in order to make sure that it's community led, there needs to be community projects, or there needs to be state intervention making sure that communities are served by solar directly. So like there is mini generation spread in the communities. I don't think it's realistic that everybody is going to be a house owner. Like, maybe if we break capitalism, everybody can have their own home and not be an owner, etc.
That's a bit
in the future. But to get by in the meantime, there needs to be a community project. So the money needs to be given to communities as grants with the purpose of making community-based infrastructure for renewables. That's basically what you need to do because not everybody has the privilege of having enough money to build their own solar system. So I think
we'll wrap up now.
Wrap up because it's an hour and a half.
But it's very super interesting. It's
been a great discussion. And I hope can do this again, maybe get people a bit more advanced notice. We were not very good at organizing ourselves, and get more people from the solar fund community in, not just Clark, but also like a lot of the writers and the artists. And it's been great and a very big source of inspiration and ideas.
And thank you to Green New Deal Europe and DiEM25 to actually organize this meeting.
Yeah, you've been great, guys.
Thanks a lot.